Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. We know you're all about getting to the good stuff fast, no sluff, right?
Absolutely, and that's exactly what we're doing today.
We're diving headfirst into a case that's, well, it's kind of a legal marathon. A Texas death penalty case that's been going on for decades. Multiple trials, appeals upon appeals, the works.
Belle v. State,
that's the one. We're going to break down the most important legal and procedural issues that came up in the appeal of Belle's second conviction.
Specifically, we've got the podcast materials. We looked at a really detailed case brief analysis. And of course, we've got the full legal brief too.
Everything we need to really get you up to speed, especially if you're a law student, this is the kind of stuff you got to know. So let's get into it, huh? What's the first big thing Belle argued in his appeal?
Well, at the core of it was the question of evidence. Did the state really prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he would be a danger to society in the future? You know, enough to justify a death sentence.
Right. And on top of that, was there enough focus on things that might make his sentence less severe, you know, mitigating factors?
Yeah, exactly. So Belle's argument was that the prosecution just didn't meet that burden of proof for future dangerousness.
So what was the state's response to that? What was their big argument?
They pointed to the original crime itself, the 1974 murder of Ferd Chisholm. It was brutal, planned out. The evidence showed a robbery that turned into an execution-style killing.
Killing stuff.
Absolutely. They also brought up some alleged threats that Belle made while he was in prison.
And how did the court ultimately rule on all this? Did they side with Belle or the state?
They went with the jury's original decision. And here's where it gets interesting for those studying law. In Texas, a jury can decide on future dangerousness based solely on the facts of the crime.
So they don't necessarily need extra evidence like prison threats?
Not necessarily. In this case, the court said the planned robbery and the sheer violence of the murder, those things alone were strong enough evidence to support the jury's finding. They didn't even have to rely heavily on those prison threats.
Wow. So the brutality of the crime itself was basically enough. Now, Belle did try to present mitigating factors, right? Things that might make a jury lean towards a less severe sentence.
Right. He argued things like his age at the time, his good behavior while he was in prison, and even potential intellectual disability.
Did any of that sway the court?
It didn't change the outcome. And this is another important takeaway about the legal system. Juries have a lot of power in deciding how much weight to give to mitigating factors.
So even if there are things that could point towards a lighter sentence, the jury doesn't have to see it that way.
Exactly. The appellate court will only overturn a jury's decision on these things if the mitigating evidence is so strong and clear that basically no reasonable juror could ignore it.
So it has to be like completely undeniable.
That's the idea. In Belle's case, the court said his evidence didn't meet that super high standard. Think of it like the jury's holding a scale, and unless the mitigating evidence tips that scale in a really dramatic way, their initial judgment stands.
That's intense. It really shows how hard it is to overturn a jury's decision in a death penalty case, especially when it comes to the sentence itself.
It highlights the huge amount of trust that's placed in the jury's ability to weigh all the evidence, both what makes the crime worse and what might make the defendant less guilty in their eyes.
Right, so we've covered future dangerousness and mitigation, but Belle also had some issues with how the trial itself was conducted, right? He claimed there were procedural errors.
He did. Belle argued that the trial court made several mistakes, and these formed the basis of his appeal.
What kind of mistakes were we talking about?
Three main ones. First, he wanted to change the location of the trial, arguing that all the media attention before the trial made it impossible to find a fair jury in that area.
Oh yeah, I can see how that would be a problem, with potential jurors already having opinions about the case before even hearing the evidence.
Right. Second, Belle argued that his confession shouldn't have been allowed as evidence because he claimed his arrest was unlawful.
That sounds like it could be a violation of his Fourth Amendment rights.
Right.
Protection from unreasonable search and seizure.
Well, that definitely concerned. And lastly, there was an issue with a witness who, well, they heard other witnesses testify before taking the stand themselves, which is a big no-no in most trials.
So let's break those down one by one, starting with the change of venue request. What did the court say about Belle's claim that he couldn't get a fair trial because of all the media coverage?
They acknowledged that pretrial publicity can absolutely be a problem. Too much media attention, especially if it's biased or inflammatory, can taint the jury pool. They even cited a landmark case, Shepard v. State, to back that up.
So they understood the concern.
They did, but in Belle's case, they found that while there was media coverage, it wasn't the kind that would automatically prevent a fair trial.
What was different about the coverage in this case?
The court noted that the media reports were mostly factual. They weren't trying to sensationalize the story or stir up public outrage.
So just reporting the facts of the case, not trying to influence anyone's opinion.
Exactly. And that distinction was key. The court basically said, look, just because a case is in the news, it doesn't mean a fair jury can't be found.
Okay, that makes sense. So they set a pretty high bar for what kind of media coverage would actually justify moving a trial. Now, what about Bell's confession? He said it shouldn't be allowed because his arrest was illegal.
This is where we get into some really interesting legal territory. It's all about the Brown v. Illinois attenuation doctrine.
Attenuation doctrine.
It's a mouthful, right. But think of it this way. Imagine there's a bad smell, like something spilled and it stinks. If you move far enough away or if enough time passes, you might not smell it anymore, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that with evidence. Even if there was an initial illegal act, like an unlawful arrest, the connection to later evidence can get weaker over time.
So the taint from that first illegal act can kind of fade away.
Exactly. So in Bell's case, the court said, okay, even if the initial arrest was bad, there are other things to consider.
Like what?
Well, he was arrested again later, and this time with a proper warrant.
Okay, so a valid arrest this time.
Yeah, and they also determined that Bell's confession was given voluntarily. No one was coercing him or forcing him to talk. Because of these things happening after the initial arrest, the court said, look, we can't just throw out his confession. It seems like a genuine statement.
So it's a balancing act between protecting someone's rights after a potentially illegal act and also acknowledging that a later statement might be totally legitimate.
That's the heart of it. It's one of those legal gray areas where you have to weigh all the factors involved.
Makes sense. Now, what about that witness who heard other witnesses testify? Remind me again, what's the rule there?
It's called the rule, and it's spelled out in the Texas Rules of Evidence, specifically Rule 614.
And basically it means witnesses can't hang out and listen to each other's stories before taking the stand.
Exactly. It's to prevent them from influencing each other, consciously or unconsciously.
Seems pretty important for ensuring that each witness's testimony is truly their own.
Absolutely. So yeah, a witness in Bell's trial messed up. They heard some testimony they weren't supposed to.
Whoops. Did the trial court do anything about it?
They did acknowledge the mistake, but they still let the witness testify.
And the appellate court was okay with that.
Well, here's the thing. Trial judges have some wiggle room in these situations. Unless the appealing party, in this case Bell, can show that this mistake actually prejudiced the case, appellate courts tend to give the trial court the benefit of the doubt.
So just breaking a rule isn't enough. Bell had to show that it actually changed the outcome of the trial.
Right. And in this case, he couldn't do that. The appellate court basically said, look, even though the rule was broken, we don't see any evidence that this witness's testimony actually swayed the jury one way or another.
So a mistake was made, but it didn't seem to matter in the grand scheme of things.
Basically.
Okay, moving on. What about Bell's complaints about the jury instructions? What was that all about?
One of his arguments focused on something called Article 38.23.
What's that?
It's a specific instruction that a judge can give to the jury. It tells them, in a nutshell, to ignore any evidence they believe was obtained illegally.
So if Bell thought his confession was tainted because of a bad arrest, he would want the jury to be told they could just disregard it.
Exactly. But there's a catch.
What's the catch?
This Article 38.23 instruction is only needed if there's a real disagreement about the facts of how the evidence was obtained. Like if the police gave conflicting stories about how they got a confession, then the jury would need guidance on whether to even consider that evidence.
So a disagreement about what actually happened.
Yeah, like a he said, she said situation.
Yeah.
But in Bell's case, the facts of the arrest and confession weren't really in dispute.
So everyone agreed on what happened, but the argument was about whether what happened was legal or not.
Exactly. And that's a question for the judge to decide, not the jury.
Ah, okay. So it's not the jury's job to decide if the police acted legally. That's up to the judge.
Right. And since there wasn't a factual dispute about what went down during the arrest and confession, the court said an Article 38.23 instruction wasn't necessary.
Okay, I get it now. What was the other issue with the jury instruction? Something about when they were deadlocked.
Right. So after deliberating for a while, the jury said they couldn't reach a unanimous verdict. They were stuck.
Happens sometimes.
It does. So the judge told them to keep deliberating.
Seems reasonable enough. Give them another chance to try and come to a decision.
Yeah, but Bell argued that this was basically coercing the jury, pressuring them to reach a verdict they might not otherwise agree on.
Interesting. I guess it could feel like pressure. If you're a juror who's not convinced, and the judge is telling you to keep talking it out.
Exactly. But the appellate court didn't see it that way. They relied on a case called Allen v. State to make their decision.
What's the key takeaway from Allen?
It says that judges can encourage juries to keep trying for a consensus, but they can't force them or make them feel like they have to agree just to please the court.
So the judge can say, keep trying, but not, you have to come to a decision no matter what.
Exactly. The appellate court carefully looked at what the judge said to Bell's jury and decided that the judge's words were just encouragement, not coercion.
So it was more like, keep working at it, not, you're in trouble if you don't come back with a verdict.
Exactly. And that's why they upheld the trial court's handling of the deadlocked jury.
Okay, that makes sense. Anything else important about these procedural challenges?
Yeah, one more crucial point. It's about something called preservation of error.
Okay, I'm all ears.
In simple terms, it means you can't just bring up brand new arguments on appeal.
So the appeal isn't like a whole new trial where you can raise any issue you want.
Right. If you want to challenge something on appeal, you generally have to have already objected to that specific thing during the trial itself.
So you can't just bring a surprise argument on the appellate court?
Not usually. It's all about fairness and giving the trial court a chance to correct any mistakes right then and there.
So if Bill's lawyers didn't object to something during the trial, they probably couldn't bring it up for the first time on appeal.
That's the gist of it. It's a fundamental part of how the appellate process works.
Interesting. Now, before we wrap up, I remember reading that even though the court upheld Bell's conviction and sentence, one of the judges, Judge Baird, had a slightly different take on things.
Yes, Judge Baird issued a concurring opinion. That means he agreed with the final decision, but he had some different thoughts about how they got there.
So he thought Bell was guilty and deserved the death penalty, but maybe he disagreed with some of the reasoning behind upholding the trial court's actions.
You got it. Specifically, he disagreed with the majority's reasoning on some of those preserved errors we talked about. He thought some of the trial court's decisions were a bit closer to being actual errors than the other judges did.
So he had a stricter interpretation of the rules, maybe?
That's often the case with Judge Baird. He's known for being very rigorous when it comes to procedural rules, especially in death penalty cases.
So even though they all agreed on the final outcome, there were some subtle differences in how they viewed the legal technicalities?
Exactly. It just goes to show that even experienced judges can have different perspectives on how to apply the law in complex cases.
Well, this has been quite a deep dive, and we've covered a lot of ground. Any final thoughts on Bell v. State? What are the key takeaways our listeners should remember?
Here are the big ones. One, appellate courts in Texas really defer to the jury's decisions in death penalty cases, especially on future dangerousness and mitigating factors. Overturning those decisions is extremely difficult.
So basically what the jury decides carries a lot of weight.
A lot of weight. Two, if there were mistakes during the trial, the burden is on the person appealing to show not just that the mistake happened, but that it actually affected the outcome of the case.
So mistakes happen, but they have to be significant mistakes.
Right. Three, legal challenges can drag on for decades. Bell's case is a prime example. Remember, he got a retrial years later because of a habeas corpus ruling.
That's where someone argues they're being unlawfully imprisoned, right?
Exactly. But even after all that time and effort, the retrial still has to follow all the complex rules of evidence and procedure.
So it's not a clean slate. It's more like round two with the same rules in place.
Precisely. And lastly, this case really underscores how important the jury is in Texas death penalty cases. Even when there's evidence that might point towards a less severe punishment, the ultimate decision rests with those 12 jurors.
Powerful stuff. It's really a reminder that behind all these legal terms and procedures, there are real people whose lives are at stake.
Absolutely. Bell v. State is a stark illustration of the complexity and weight of the legal system, especially when dealing with the ultimate punishment.
It definitely leaves you with a lot to think about. For those of you studying law, this case is a real-world example of how core legal principles, like the standard of evidence and due process, play out in the most serious situations.
Cases like this aren't just abstract concepts. They're reminders that the law has immense power and affects people's lives in profound ways.
So true. I think the big question this case raises is, how do we balance the jury's authority with ensuring a truly fair process every step of the way? And how do we make sure our legal precedents, those past rulings, are applied consistently and justly, especially when someone's life is on the line?
It's a question that deserves ongoing debate and scrutiny.
Absolutely. We'll have to leave it there for now, but this case definitely gives us all a lot to ponder. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Bell v. State.
Thanks for listening, everyone.